Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. You know the drill. We record on Friday morning. Before we introduce our Rethink the Week panel, I thought, because we're still in Women's History Month, I would share with you a quote by Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And Lincoln Mitchell wrote a sort of interesting response when I posted it. When I was growing up, there were no women in orchestras. Auditioners thought they could tell the difference between a woman playing and a man. Some intelligent person devised a simple solution. Drop a curtain between the auditioners and the people trying out. And lo and behold, women began to get jobs in symphony orchestras. Oh God, it kills me. Anyway, that was a quote by Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And then because it is our Rethink the Week on Monday, we usually get a limerick from Anthony Tenzer. And here is his political limerick. He warns us that he'll be arrested. This bully with golden hair crested, will he perp walk smiling, all the while defiling the poor souls that he has molested? Joining us for our Rethink the Week panel is a really wonderful group of guests. We have Dave Leventhal. He leads Raw Stories Newsroom as editor-in-chief and oversees its investigations and enterprise reporting. He is based in Washington, D.C. He previously worked as a deputy editor and senior Washington correspondent for Insider. He also worked as an editor and reporter at the Center for Public Integrity, Politico, Open Secrets, the Dallas Morning News. And when I met him, he was a young kid working for the Eagle Tribune. Welcome back to the program, Dave. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Arnie. Great to be back.
Stephen Pepere is the director of the Public Service and Nonprofit Leadership Program at the University of New Hampshire. He is the author of New Victorians, Politics, Poverty, and Propaganda. I guess I said that wrong. Anyway, his newest book is Politics for Social Workers, which is now getting incredible praise and, of course, incredibly timely. Welcome back to the program, Mr. Pepere.
Thank you, Arnie. Good to be here as ever.
And Lincoln Mitchell teaches political science and public policy at the Columbia University. He is the author of 7 books, and his writings have appeared in CNN, Reuters, the New York Times, NBC, and the San Francisco Examiner. He has now a new Substack entitled Kibitzing with Lincoln, and I want to welcome Lincoln back to the program.
Thank you for having me back.
And it has been way too long, Val Endres. Val Endres is a professor of political communications at Rhode Island College, and she was part of the Rhode Island College's role in American democracy. And your ears should have been burning, Val, because we were talking about on WGBH about your state and your congressman who has decided to retire, Dave Cicilline. And I was just thinking, Val, I'm so glad you're here. So welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Arnie. It's great to be here.
I didn't want to start with this, and I just maybe didn't even send it to you because I saw it this morning on Twitter, but because there is so much happening in Florida, good, bad, and ugly. I'm trying to think, is there any good? No, just bad and ugly, I think is what's happening in Florida. Someone sent me this from their Twitter feed. The Florida NAACP unanimously voted to ask the NAACP National Board to issue a travel advisory. The advisory would ask people to forego visiting and moving to the Sunshine State. So I guess I'm going to start with you, Stephen Pepere. I've been waiting for things like this to happen. I mean, I can't imagine teaching there. I can't imagine going to college there. I don't want a vacation there. And I'm looking at every kind of thing that is coming out of Ron DeSantis because he's using the state of Florida as his sort of conservative, authoritarian, fascist petri dish. But then when I saw that, I was like, all right, don't laugh, Arnie. But in some ways, this had to happen. The question was just when. And then on top of that, there was another report that came out from Disney World. And of course, you know how Ron DeSantis has been attacking Disney World. And Disney World announced that they're like holding an event in the fall for the LGBTQ community and transgender issues, almost as a way of flipping their middle fingers up at Ron DeSantis. But Florida is going down this black hole, and I'm not sure all Floridians are really as aware of what he's doing to them, but they're slowly coming to grips.
So I guess, Arnie, it's not entirely clear to me that Florida is radically different than what's going on in lots of other states and cities throughout the United States right now. If anything, maybe it is a difference in degree rather than in kind. Going to the NAACP, possible admonition against travel. If you are a young black man in an automobile driving down the road, You are in danger in arguably most places in the country, not merely Florida, right? And we've, well, now decades worth of documentation about the ways in which merely being Black and in a car in a public space, particularly if it's a nice looking car, can literally endanger your safety, your freedom, and your life. I get it. Florida, you know, we've got sort of all the Florida man jokes, and it's easy to make jokes. And of course, none of this is funny. I think we miss something important if we characterize Florida as somehow different than what we can see going on in lots and lots and lots of other places.
I hear what Stephen is saying. And yes, there has been systemic racism. And yes, a lot of these seeds have been fertilized all over the country. But Florida is moving at exponential speed. That's what I see with Florida. Is that it's like Ron DeSantis isn't doing one thing. He's doing 20 things. He's taking over colleges. He's taking over school boards. He's making sure that books are being banned. He is doing things at such a rate that I think it's even beginning to become shocking to people in Florida. So my sister-in-law lives, Dave, in Sarasota, and she sent me an op-ed from Sarasota going, like, we used to be nice. Like what happened to us? It was like, it's almost like they're not even sure they recognize the place that they're now living in. But yet, for whatever reason, Ron DeSantis holds his huge margin of victory over everyone. And of course, you know that he and the former president are sort of interestingly duking it out. And I'm not sure whether what Ron is doing to Florida is going to ultimately help him not only win a nomination, but let win the presidency, Dave.
Well, let's look at it from Ron DeSantis's perspective, perhaps. So he's got a state right now that is the fastest growing state in the United States per U.S. Census data just a couple of months ago when it was released. You've got not only that population booming, but business is booming. People want to come to Florida because of economic opportunities or to retire there, whatever the case may be. So he's feeling pretty good about life at this point. And clearly, when it comes to the politics of it all, he's willing to kind of say and do whatever he wants to say and do while at the same time pursuing a national profile for himself, which almost certainly is going to lead to him running for president in 2024. But what you have also, too, are some interesting countervailing forces that are coming where you're probably going to see, Arnie, many more calls for boycotts or people not having their conventions in Orlando or boycott, you know, going to the beach and go somewhere else. And all of this is going to come crashing together in a, I think, a fairly interesting way over the next couple of years, particularly if Ron DeSantis is running for president. And let's say he loses. Well, I mean, the conversation around Florida as a state could be very different in material ways in not 2 years if ultimately those things come to pass.
Val, what drives me nuts about Florida, and I hear all the people that want to live there, and I hear the success of businesses, and you know, again, I want to repeat what happened, that Ron DeSantis targets Disney World. He basically wants to take over their sort of governing body. And then, of course, and here's the actual headline, Disney World to host out an equal event in support of LGBTQ rights in the workplace. The event is scheduled to take place in September, and it pushes back against DeSantis's LGBTQ agenda. So I want to hold that up there with what happened with the NAACP, but I also want to remind everyone that when Donald Trump won the presidency in Florida, at the same time, I think, as that was happening, my understanding is that they basically restored the right to vote with ex-felons with 60% plus of the vote. They raised the minimum wage in Florida. There's like a split screen. Like, what they want and what they've elected are so different. And yes, Florida might be successful, but in some ways, isn't Ron DeSantis making it into a conflagration and a fire? I hear I want to be in Florida, and then I begin to hear all this poisonous information. And I don't know about you, but I'm beginning to think, why would I want to go there? And it may not happen immediately, but over the course of the next year, if I were a teacher, I'd never show up. If I was a doctor, I would never show up. If I was a nurse, I would never show up. I mean, I'm looking at all those professions that are essential for Florida to continue to survive and be successful. And all of those things are being said to people and saying, I'm taking that welcome mat away from you.
You could look at this in a couple of different ways. My niece argues, and she lives in the state of Georgia, And she argues that more people should be moving to the South and more Democrats should be moving to the South because that's the only way that you can change things. And I know that that's a difficult pill to swallow. And particularly since, you know, you said Florida used to be nice, but let's remember just recently they reelected Ron DeSantis, knowing full well who he is. And so there's that issue, you know, and as far as Disney is concerned, it's a win-win for Disney. You know, Disney is a major, major corporation and has taken advantage of what Ron DeSantis and the state legislature gave them to run basically their own city and to choose whether they pay taxes or not. And so the fact that Disney pushed back on this, they had really nothing to lose at this point. DeSantis sees them as the enemy right now. They can pick up some good PR by doing this. I don't know what to say about DeSantis and Florida, other than the fact that all the attention that goes to DeSantis doesn't deflect from what we're talking about with other states. And I'm going back to Stephen's point about that. It's important. He's running for president. He wants the attention there. He's moving in that direction. And so there you go.
Well, let me just say something. So Lincoln, he is maybe running for president. We don't know yet. It's going to require the Florida legislature to actually change their laws in order for him to run again, because he can't double dip. And he wants to basically have an insurance plan in case he doesn't make the nomination. What we do know is Donald Trump has been all over him. Okay. He started to attack. But what is fascinating to me is that it's been successful, Trump's attacks on DeSantis, because DeSantis in the last month has actually seen his polling numbers begin to drop dramatically. All right. But what I think is maybe a gift to Ron DeSantis is what's happening in New York, because Donald Trump is completely and totally unraveling, completely and totally unraveling. The kinds of threats he's making, the words he's using, everything that's happening is like, so it's even over the top for Donald Trump, which is like almost impossible to imagine. But I think we're getting to that point. And what I think is interesting is that while he was successful in attacking DeSantis, this moment in time may be the DeSantis rehabilitation plan, because Trump is so out of his mind. And I just think if he's out of his mind with this possible indictment, where is he going to go by the second indictment and the third indictment and the fourth indictment? I'm not sure he gets to sort of even stay on planet Earth.
Well, I'm glad we've switched from Florida to New York, because I'm much more familiar with the latter. But I just want to say very, very, very briefly about Florida. If we discuss Florida, and if DeSantis cares anything about Florida, he has to focus on climate change, about which he does not care.
Yes,
and has
exactly.
Done nothing. And that is a real threat to Florida. So there are a lot of reasons not to move there. I'd have nothing against Florida. It's always been one of my 50 favorite states. There's a lot of reasons not to move there. But climate change may be the biggest. As you think down the road, you're right that this potential indictment has unraveled Trump even more. Pardon the syntax there. But I want to just raise two points there. One, he announced, I believe, last weekend, I'm going to be indicted and arrested on Tuesday. And everyone talked about that all week long. And Trump's primal political skill is to get us to talk about what he wants to talk about, even as he is unraveling, even as he is growing even more disconnected from reality. And that is what we saw this week. I'm going to, which I rarely do, kind of support what I think is some of the emerging kind of conventional wisdom on this. I think the big loser from a Trump indictment from Alvin Bragg is Ron DeSantis. Because what happened this week is the Republican Party once again got veered off of everything else they were trying to do and went back to defending their cult leader, Donald Trump. And we saw that in the House of Representatives. And we saw even Ron DeSantis, who got off a pretty decent soundbite about, I don't know how to pay off a porn star, but, you know, this is a witch hunt, right?
Yeah.
Not a bad soundbite. But the point is, he's talking about what Trump wants him to talk about. So my sense is that this does not hurt Trump in a primary. And the polls keep showing that. The kind of punditocracy, and I wrote about this week actually on my Substack, has decided that we're done with Donald Trump and he's not going to be the nominee. The polls and Republican primary voters are saying something different. I don't think this knocks Trump out of the primary. I think it probably helps Joe Biden in a general election because Trump is increasingly unelectable in a general. But as we talk about Ron DeSantis, and we've said on the show in the last few minutes, he's probably going to run. He hasn't officially announced. No. There are some legal and logistical hurdles, and there also are some political ones, which is that at the end of the day, he may not be a very good candidate. Yes. He has not demonstrated an ability to go and mobilize voters. And the Republicans have got themselves in this situation where they have these two titans wrestling for control of the party. And the candidates who are more likely to win are the Nikki Haley's, the Tim Scott's if he runs. But these two, there's no oxygen left in the room because of Trump and DeSantis, who are kind of the leading two faces of the same fascist coin.
So as I'm listening to him, Stephen, I do think I'll take it back. We are now I'm horrified by what I see Donald Trump doing because I just think it is just so way over the top. But I keep forgetting this is called Trump entertainment. Trump knows exactly what he's doing. He's absolutely right. And he knows that he has to, because of what happened, where he basically said, you know, that I'm going to be arrested on Tuesday and it didn't happen. So in order for him to continue to elevate the conversation and to keep attracting, because he made that sort of suggestion and it didn't happen, he has to get even more crazy. He has to carry the bat behind the head of Bragg, all these kinds of things. What did Bill Clinton say? It's better to be loud and wrong than quiet and right. And what Donald Trump has done is he's done loud on steroids. And it's absolutely true. We all follow him. The media follows him. You and I follow him. And frankly, that's what the Republicans want. They want someone that's being followed because that's the man they're going to choose, Stephen Pimbert.
You know, remember that Trump is, I think, and I don't mean this to be anything other than descriptive, a malignant narcissist by all reasonable accounts. And what he wants more than anything is to be the center of attention. And, you know, if being the center of attention means you get arrested and perped walked into prison, well, that's one way to do it. So I don't know that that would necessarily trouble him. I think the other thing to observe here is that since he made, though we now know, inaccurate prediction that he would be arrested on Tuesday, he raised something like $1.1 or $1.5 million, right? I do not think that is coincidental, right? I think it is part of what is always at work with Trump, which is that it is always a grift more than it is anything. The entire Trump presidency, as we learn over time, was an elaborate grift. When we look at the amount of money that we know poured into his businesses and his adult children's businesses, right? So none of this harms him. I just briefly want to bounce back, connect something that both Val and Lincoln said. Going back to Disney, Disney is an enormously large global corporation. The majority of Americans are not anti-gay bigots, right? They are following the money in this regard, right? And DeSantis is not the money. More importantly, Lincoln talked about Florida and climate change. There was this week a new report released by the IPCC. And I think that we need to make sure that we talk about it because we have so normalized the fact that we are facing catastrophic doom that even among us here, it is not on the very top of the list of things that we want to talk about.
Well, I think I have a Harper's Magazine, I think, in front of me, Dave Leventhal. And the Harper's Magazine cover says the following: the incredible disappearing doomsday, how the media stopped worrying about climate change. That's exactly what Stephen Pimbert said. That is the cover of my Harper's that just came in, Dave. And again, this is the American people. You know, there's going to be a fire. There's going to be a fire. There's going to be a fire. Sure, sure, sure. Oh my God, there's a fire. We are incapable of preparing. We're incapable of sort of looking ahead and saying this could happen at the end of the week. Well, the answer is, well, we're not at the end of the week. I mean, that is exactly where we are. And it just is, to me, it is so, so terrifying because you keep wanting to scream. We have lost a sense of generational ethics. We don't care about the future. Everything we do, in part because of how we financialized everything. Think about how banks work now. Banks used to be the person that said, no, you can't afford that house. And then they came up with the concept of liar loans. You know, I mean, so we have drained out of the American ethic anything that says prepare for the future. It's all about the now. And that's why what, you know, when I hear Stephen Pimper talking about the report that came out, I talked about that report. But you know what? Nobody gave a, you know what, a crap, Dave. And if they don't give it a crap here on my show, imagine what happens in Congress. Niente.
Well, on one hand, Arnie, people, it's human nature. They're not going to focus on the thing that is happening at the end of the week because they got things that are happening today. And I think we can find a few examples across history where that very much is true. Now, on the other hand, too, the end of the week is showing up pretty darn quickly for a lot of people. Okay. Yes. We're seeing this in North Carolina with homes literally falling into the Atlantic Ocean in tourist areas where people have gone to their vacation home every year and now can't because that house literally is not there. Now, if you go to Florida, there was another report that came out recently. It was from the Center for Landscape Conservation Planning at the University of Florida. And I mean, it's just projecting out to 2040. I was in Fort Myers, Florida, not too many weeks ago, and Fort Myers Beach, it's gone. I mean, there's nothing there. Hotels that were there don't exist. Houses that people were living in a year ago, a hurricane blew them away. And we're going to see a lot more of that, as we well know. It's just simply a scientific fact that things are getting worse in that regard over time. So, you know, when coastlines begin to disappear, yeah, the end of the week shows up, and it's showing up not universally in Florida or the coast, but in enough pockets right now where the conversation ostensibly will have to change because people literally can't live in the places that they used to be able to reasonably live in not too long ago.
Can I do something really ridiculous, Dave? And that is, I want to take it to SVB, Silicon Valley Bank. So we saw this big bank go under, okay? The 16th largest bank in America, largest bank since 2008 to go under. And what is the response? We bailed out every depositor. Every single depositor. And someone said once, you know, they have the, and when you register with your bank up at the, usually at where the bank teller is, it says, you know, this are FDIC protected up to $250,000. Right. Apparently I was the only one that read that because 90% of the investments in CVB were over $250,000. So what was the answer to that? We're going to cover everybody's deposit. And now there's a really good argument for doing it for everyone in the country. All right. Not just for SVB. But here's the problem. So we're going to cover everybody's deposit. And then we're looking at what's happening as the result of the climate crisis. Are we going to cover everyone's lost home? Are we going to cover everyone's lost front porch? I mean, I am looking at this going, we can't raise enough money to do what we need to do with the failing infrastructure we have. And now with the climate crisis, we're going to see failing happening at an exponential rate. And everyone's going to turn to the government they hate, the government they don't want to pay taxes to, the government they don't want to see regulations from. And they're going to say, where are you? Dave, it makes me crazy.
Well, it makes a lot of people crazy, too. And I think one thing you're going to hear from Democrats a lot in the context of congressional elections coming up, and obviously the presidential election coming up, is, do you want Donald Trump or Ron DeSantis being at the top of the heap when real serious decisions that affect people's lives, that affect the ability for people to live in places in this country, for the financial system to operate properly? Do you want them making that kind of decision, or do you want somebody else? So is that going to be a compelling argument? That's a whole different discussion. But at the same time, too, expect that that's going to be a certain political line that you're going to hear over and over, and in certain respects already have.
All right. So this is why I've set up for you, Valendris, because Dave Cicilline, your congressman from Rhode Island, has announced he's leaving. Now, why am I going from SVB and all these things to Dave Cicilline? Because he was known as the great antitrust, anti-monopoly buster. That was his focus. He didn't even know a decade ago that that would be his focus. It never even occurred to him. And suddenly he was sort of handed the torch and he took it up. And I think that one of the reasons he may be leaving Congress is that he's no longer in the majority and he doesn't have the same power he had. And I think that's so frustrating. But he understood and was able to educate people on this issue. And look what we're losing.
I don't necessarily think that he's alone in thinking about leaving Congress. And it's a long slog to get reelected every 2 years. And I think that when you're in the minority party, especially, and things move at such a slow pace, other job possibilities are really attractive. And he's going to a job where it pays over $600,000 a year. He's tripling his income. But I think it does bring up these larger issues about what Congress people have to do to raise money in order to go into office every 2 years, the expense of going back and forth from home to Washington, D.C., the kind of skill sets that it takes. And David Cicilline has mad skill sets. He's a great debater. He's great
exactly.
on media. He's continuing to be a rising star. He is a star. But we saw this in the state of Rhode Island, where the two leading candidates, one was an executive for CVS and can self-finance a campaign, who nearly won the gubernatorial Democratic primary, decided not to run. And the House Speaker, who has a war chest of over $1.5 million, decided not to run. And they're, I'm sure, opting for other offices, such as gubernatorial office, where the campaign can be more grueling, but you're in the limelight right away.
And let me just say something else now, and because I'm going to have to end this segment. But the other thing is that Dave Cicilline was not brought into leadership. So after Nancy Pelosi handed the torch off, and Cicilline should have been in leadership. I mean, what a slap in the face, everyone. I want people to understand that not only is he brilliant on so many of the issues you care about, and I think between being in the minority and then being rejected by his own party, he is a rising star, but obviously not by the new Democrats or the financial Democrats or whatever those Democrats are called. I'm not even sure they're Democrats anymore, but I think that was such a harm to him that he figures, why not just go back to Rhode Island, make some money, regroup, and then figure out what to do. He also may be either looking at the gubernatorial race or running for U.S. Senate, where at least you're just one of two and not a pack. When I saw that he was leaving, I was just so depressed, because if there was a time now to push back on the monopolization and the trust that we are seeing that are hurting us on every level. I mean, what's wrong with CVB isn't just that its bank failed. It's that it's going to be this rush to the big four. No, we don't need more, you know, concentration in the financial markets. We need more diversity in the financial markets. How do we ensure that community banks and regional banks exist? Well, you know what? Going to a big bank ain't the answer. And yet that's something I think Cicilline understood. And that's what's so depressing. All right, everyone. This is the first half of Rethink the Week, the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We will continue our conversation with Val Endres, Lincoln Mitchell, Stephen Pimpare, and Dave Leventhal when we come back.
One last thought about the possibility of a Trump indictment. We waited all last week. We talked about this all last week. Trump once again set the agenda, but he wasn't indicted. He still may be indicted, which gives him another week to get us to talk about this. But one thing to keep in mind is that if he is indicted, it's not like he will then be sitting in a jail cell somewhere or be tried right away. He will not be in pretrial detention because he's rich and he's white, so he will be at large and his trial will be looming. And that will continue to dominate, maybe not politics, but certainly Republican politics. And then maybe there will be a trial, and maybe he will be found guilty, or maybe not. In any case, the Trump indictment story is one that, for the purposes of Republican politics and Republican primary politics, has very long legs. And that is very good for Donald Trump, because it means it will be more difficult both to switch the topic of conversation to something else within the Republican Party, and for any other Republican Party candidate, and here I'm speaking very specifically of Ron DeSantis, to break through.
The Mitchell Minute is a brief and hard-hitting daily comment about political events from me, Professor Lincoln Mitchell. If you want to hear the Mitchell Minute every day, you can...
When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history. When your parents lived through things that looked so much like this. All the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place. And you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance. When you know for many people this will be their last chance. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth. When you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth. When they're opening the camps not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before. When Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news. When the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. feels like 1933. When you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity. When you know where the kids are kept locked inside their cells. When you see approaching the future this foretells. When they're coming for your neighbors. When they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away. When you know where they keep the buses. You've been to the parking lot. Perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1930.
Back to part two of the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. You know, we call it Rethink the Week. The talkers that are joining us are Dave Leventhal, who is Raw Stories Newsroom Editor-in-Chief and oversees its investigation and enterprise reporting. Stephen Pepper is the Director of Public Service and Nonprofit Leadership Program at the University of New Hampshire. Val Endres is a Professor of Communications at Rhode Island College. And Lincoln Mitchell teaches Political Science and Public Policy at Columbia University. He has a new Substack that is entitled Kibitzing with Lincoln. So welcome back to the program. I want to start again with you, Mr. Pepper, and I asked during the break, where would you like to go? This is important. You brought us back to something that I think we cannot forget, that huge mistake called the Iraq War. And I would love to hear what your thoughts are. What is it, 20 years later? Yeah. We were right about the mistake then. We're right about the mistake now. The question is, do we learn from these mistakes or just repeat them?
Well, I think the answer is no, we never learn from those mistakes and we always repeat them.
Yes.
So there you go. I was one of those folks on the streets of New York in what, up until the Black Lives Matter protests of 2020, were probably the largest global mass demonstrations in all of recorded human history, right? Which, and, you know, I narrowly escaped arrest like other people, and we were screaming and yelling, and we were right. Right on every count. We were absolutely right about the false pretenses, about the ways in which we were being lied to, about the enormous human cost of our invasion, right? There are estimates that there are a million or more Iraqis who are dead because of our intervention, right? That is enormous quantities of blood that we have on our hands, right? There is a larger lesson that I take away from this that I think is not a lesson that most people take away, is that for all of the condemnation of those protests and ultimately the dismissal of them, the lesson that I take, given how right we were, is that we would have been justified in being that much more aggressive, that much more vocal, that much more consistent, and maybe even that much more destructive, right? We were right. We knew we were right. We showed up. We made a little bit of noise, and then we walked away. Think about what we've been talking about in terms of the urgency of climate. I think one of the lessons of the Iraq War is that if mass mobilization is going to influence the political system, it needs to be outsized and sustained. Take a look at what's going on in France right now, right? In some ways, there's a really interesting and perhaps useful model there. Is the fact that Miami could be underwater in 15 years and other cities to come a large enough crisis that we should shut the damn country down until the political system responds in an appropriate way?
I appreciate what Stephen says, but let me just say something here. And that is that what's happening in France impacts every single walking person. You are raising the retirement age from 62 to 64. But there is an immediacy and a knowledge. You have a grandparent or a parent or whatever. It is so universal and so personal in a country that really believes that there should be a robust safety net. That is in their DNA. I mean, they don't believe in nonprofits, Dave Leventhal, because they say, if you have a need, you don't need to create a nonprofit. The government should do it. This is not what we do. In America, we go, oh, the nonprofits will fit in the interstices between the gaps of public policy. And then you find out that nonprofits have to step in all the time because the government has basically disappeared. So I love the model in France. I don't have never, ever really seen that model been embraced in America. We don't, whatever it is, I think we're missing that gene that understands that not only do you have to show up, but you can't just show up once, you have to show up 100 times.
This is another thing where, hey, you know, the end of the week is not here. And that's very much the case in Washington, D.C., where it's like, ah, well, the Social Security system hasn't quite fallen apart yet. We haven't totally run out
exactly.
of money. So therefore, there's going to, you know, be this proverbial kick the can down the road type thing going on for years and years. But again, the end of the week is getting closer, not to sound like a broken record. And when you have a situation like we have right now, where we're talking about raising the debt ceiling and maybe not doing that, and the economic fallout that would come from that, which would be massive if ultimately Congress doesn't do its job and do its duty, that's going to be the end of the week coming very quickly, among other things too. So expect, again, going forward and extrapolating it to the presidential campaign, to congressional races, that you're going to hear Joe Biden talk very, very specifically and directly, if he runs for president, which it appears that he will for a second term, about, hey, we need to tax the wealthiest Americans more so that we have more money in this country to put into programs to extend the life of Social Security, to not have to necessarily raise the age caps in draconian ways, et cetera, et cetera. Now, it's going to be very easy for Republicans to come back and say, oh, well, this sounds a whole lot like socialistic wealth redistribution. So that's going to be the nature of that debate and where the rub is truly going to be.
Val, excuse me, I got to go to Lincoln because we did start with the Iraq war. And I wanted to just read you a comment from an editorial at The Nation. The absence of accountability for a government that lied us into war and a media that jettisoned skepticism for stenography continues to endanger our fragile democracy to this day. I think that is an incredibly powerful line by The Nation. What I think is so frustrating about America is that there is never accountability for those at the top. I mean, where we've been talking all this time about Donald Trump, and Donald Trump has been a child of no accountability since the day he actually became 18, I think, you know, because his whole life has basically been roughshod over every rule or every process, but he's never been held accountable, even after he became president of the United States. And then I'm looking at the Iraq War. Where was the accountability? I'm looking even at Richard Nixon. Where was the accountability? This is what we know. We know not only are you too big to fail, but guess what? There is never the satisfaction of saying you made a mistake and you must be held accountable. Little people get that, but no one at the top.
That's right. And one of the reminders that I see in the Iraq War is that in Washington, it is always worse to be alone than to be wrong. So once that consensus begins to emerge, and the role of the media in Iraq, particularly in building that consensus. So even though a substantial chunk of the American people were against the war, the elite consensus just dominated it. So if you raise the kind of there are exceptions in academia, because a lot of academics, frankly, saw this coming and urged against the war. But you were shouted down by, you know, the Tom Friedmans, who were felt like, now I can support a war and that helps my career. And that was extremely disturbing. And the lessons from this war are extraordinary. One of them is it wasn't just a policy mistake. It was a policy mistake that was the result of a deliberate lie told to us by an administration that, frankly, shouldn't have been in office in the first place. I mean, let's be very honest about what was happening in the first few years of this century. That's what was happening. And I remember a conversation I had once with a guy who's a kind of a maher in the foreign policy world, who had been very senior aide to Dick Cheney. And this was long. This was by now Obama was president, about 10 years ago. And I said to him, let me ask you a question. How come all of my lefty friends in San Francisco knew there were no weapons of mass destruction and you guys didn't? And his answer was, sir, surely you're not. Any sentence that begins with surely not, you're not. Resist your temptation just to smack the person who's saying it. Surely you're not suggesting that ordinary people should be involved in foreign policy. And I said, of course we should be involved. I'm an ordinary person. I want to be involved in foreign policy decisions. But that was the arrogance. And you can draw a line from that arrogance, that government that knows everything and looks down at the opinions of the ordinary people, directly to why the movement behind Donald Trump, why the anti-vax movement got so much traction. And I wanted to just offer one last thought here, and that is about the war in Ukraine. Actually, 1A and 1B. 1A is the indictment of Vladimir Putin on war crimes. Now, Vladimir Putin is a war criminal. I do not have any doubt about that. And I was writing things critical of Vladimir Putin way before it was cool. But the United States' view on the ICC is that we will ignore it unless it is absolutely in our favor. And if we are going to indict Donald Trump, that's the Freudian slip I was about to make. If we're going to indict Vladimir Putin, we should, what about Donald Rumsfeld? What about Dick Cheney? What about George W. Bush? We have to ask those questions. And what concerns me, to bring it full circle back to Iraq, about the war in Ukraine, is that although I support Ukraine in this conflict, what I'm hearing in Washington is a rebuilding of the consensus that the UN, that the U.S. foreign policy establishment is always right, and the answer is always intervention. And the last, I don't know, century or so of history says that is not always quite that simple.
Exactly. So I'm going to end with this quote by Andrew Bacevich at the Boston Globe, Val Indres. And he says, in no small measure, the horrors falling under the heading of Trumpism and culminating in the insurrection of January 6, 2021 can be traced directly back to Bush's cadre of self-deceived deceivers. Put simply, were it not for the Iraq war, Donald Trump probably would never have become president. Oh, God, I love Andrew Bacevich. I mean, you read that. And again, it is the whole idea of accountability. You know, it's for whatever reason, we keep talking about how important democracy is, but democracy that is infiltrated by corruption and money and is incapable of finding anyone accountable. I'm not sure that's democracy, honey. It's just not my understanding of it. And yet you look at all these things, and I'm so glad you brought it up, Stephen Pimper, about this anniversary of the Iraq war, because it brings us back to this pattern and practice of mistake.
You know, it seems to me like the only real presidential power that we have are war powers. And the presidents can exercise that because they know they can galvanize the public. And Stephen had talked about protesting in the streets, and I have a tendency to agree with Arnie that it's baked into their culture and it isn't in ours. We had that some of those brief moments in history where it was mixed results. But one of the things that I think that we can do besides protest is to think about bringing back the draft. We have to make war immediate. And that seems antithetical, but the American public has to get involved and understand the true costs of war. And it doesn't mean that I want to sacrifice more people, but we need more people with skin in the game when it comes to foreign policy. And I don't know any other way to do it.
Oh my goodness. So this is like a light bulb moment, Stephen Pimper. And I'm thinking that like the war is the answer. And we have to be immediate with war. Well, you know what that feeds into? That feeds into the flood of guns that we have in America and the rise of the NRA and the idea that you don't have to be licensed to carry a gun and the idea that you can bring a gun onto the floor of the legislature. I mean, what is a gun for? A gun is not about thinking. A gun is about responding. And a gun is about responding immediately. So this whole concept of that the only answer to any foreign policy problem is to go to war really in some ways goes back to the Second Amendment and the interpretation that now has been delivered to us by Republican leaders and the NRA. And that is that you can't resolve things by conversation. There can't be nuance. There has to be black and white. And black and white usually means I'm right, you're wrong. You know, and we have to feed that gun concept. Look what they did in Michigan when they passed some slightly reasonable gun control laws. And what did the Michigan Republican Party do but compare it to Nazism? To Nazism. The idea that you should have a background check? I mean, give me strength, but look at the extreme to which we go when it comes to domestic policy. Is there any question why we would not go to war at a foreign policy level? Because it's what we know.
I think there's something else at work here as well. So if we look at the proposed Biden administration budget for the upcoming fiscal year, it's just shy of $1 trillion allocated to the thing that we euphemistically call defense. Of course, it's war and war making, about half of which is in turn then siphoned off to private contractors of one kind or another. Story from this week talking about the ways in which private equity is getting involved in eating up defense contractors.
Yes,
so that'll be just great. What could possibly go wrong there, right? it's useful, as we used to say in the Nixon years, to follow the money here. I think that what you said about guns is true in part, but I think also we need to understand that there are enormously large constituents that profit off of a violent culture saturated with weapons, both domestically and internationally. And that helps us make sense of things. Just one quick footnote to that. We also saw last week the CEO of TikTok dragged in front of a congressional committee. There's all sorts of legitimate concerns and complaints about all kinds of social media companies. But it seems to me that that particular CEO was there because of the effort to create a new existential threat from China, in part in order to continue to justify that $1 trillion in war-making money, half of which is going to private profiteering.
So, Dave, I went to Raw Story while we were talking, and I want to start connecting all these stories together. And you have an opinion piece in Raw Story that said there's a connection between Trump's likely arrest and the bank bailout. Start with multi-billionaire Peter Thiel and follow the money. All right, so here we are talking about the money all the time. I mean, again, what people don't understand, for example, when we talk about, look at the billions we've sent to Ukraine. I said, no, it's the billions we sent to Raytheon. It's the billions we sent to Lockheed. It's the billions we sent to BAE. They don't even get it. I've never heard anyone say that these billions we're sending to Ukraine isn't actually going in the form of a check. It's going in the form of some contract that we've given to some industrial complex. But I thought it was really fascinating, the opinion piece by Robert Reich, where they connect the dots between Trump's arrest and the bank bailouts. And once again, it goes to money.
You always must follow the money, Arnie. And, yes. You know, one thing that we've been writing about a ton, and that has been kind of a focal point of my work for the past couple of years, yeah, is a nexus between exactly what you described, defense contractors. Let's just take that for an example. And the people who are ultimately responsible for giving money to the defense contractors to have them make the tools of war and produce them. Well, you know, there are dozens of members of Congress who, as we speak today, are invested personally in the stocks of companies like Raytheon and Lockheed Martin, yes, and General Dynamics and Boeing, and the list goes on and on. And there's a very real debate that's happening in Congress. There are Republicans and Democrats alike who would like to ban all members of Congress from trading those types of stocks or any stocks at all because of the conflicts of interest that represents to them. So that's one thing.
But who stopped that? Who stopped that? Nancy Pelosi. If we don't say her name and we don't connect the dots, then we have failed once again, because our job in the media is not to say that there are members of Congress that want to do this, not to talk about follow the money. It's to point out who stopped it from becoming a reality. It was that wonderful leader, Nancy Pelosi. And you have to ask, how has her family benefited from being able to trade those stocks?
Well, I mean, love her or hate her.
Exactly.
Bottom line is, late last year, she had a decision to make. She could either move forward with pushing this through. And had she done that, it almost certainly would have gone through in some fashion.
It would have.
Or she had the choice to stop it. And she did the latter. That's just a fact of the matter. So it's now in Kevin McCarthy's court, largely. And there's a debate that he may see this as an opportunity to really stick it to the Democrats and say, hey, look, you know, we're the party of responsibility. We're the ones who are being ethical here. So it's probably a ways away before we get to that point. But there you go. One final point I'd like to bring up, since we're talking about following the money, is it's now 8 days past when Donald Trump was supposed to release the latest, greatest details about his personal finances. You have to do this by virtue of being a presidential candidate. We got letters between his lawyer, Trump's lawyer, and the Federal Election Commission, where the FEC is like, hey, you're late. You have to do this. Federal law says that it is required. And basically the response was crickets. So, you know, Donald Trump, here we're talking about indictments and what's happening in New York and Georgia and what might be happening with the documents in Mar-a-Lago. Well, hey, we can state today, again, as a statement of fact, that he is violating federal law, although the penalty is de minimis, for not releasing information about his personal finances, which, again, is really kind of at the heart of many of these matters, politically or personally.
So Val, I mentioned the Raw Story piece that was actually written by Robert Reich. And again, follow the money, but I just want people to see that in a lot of ways, it's such an interesting web. And he writes, start with the multi-billionaire Peter Thiel and follow the money. You may recall that in 2016, Thiel spoke at the Republican National Convention to make the case why Trump should be the next president. In the midterms election, he donated $15 million to the Republican Ohio Senatorial Committee for J.D. Vance, who alleged that the 2020 election was stolen and that Biden's immigration policy meant more Democratic voters pouring into the country. Thiel also donated at least $10 million to the Arizona Republican Party in support of Blake Masters, and he goes on and on and on. He says, Thiel and other wealthy self-described libertarians wanted Trump to be reelected in 2024. I'll get to that in a moment. What connects Thiel to the bank bailouts? Days before Silicon Valley Bank failed, Thiel's venture capital firm Founders Fund advised clients to pull their deposits out. This contributed to the run on the bank. Some $50 million of Thiel's own money was still stuck in the bank. Then guess what? Thiel and other rich depositors got bailed out by the Fed. I mean, when you put all those dollar connections together, not only do you want to take a shower, but you want to know why every time you talk about certain things, you almost need to start going, first, let me tell you a little bit about this guy. Okay, it's like you want to give the history lesson because you can't just say the name. You can't just put him in connection to SVB. You have to make all those connections and say, this is why this is a problem.
Well, and it's a web of money that continues to grow rather than decline. And one of the issues that we have to get real about is campaign finance reform. And we keep going back to that we've got to at least break that tie where we can with campaign contributions from major corporations and from billionaires, you know, and we had talked about the follow the money in war, we can talk about following the money with insurance companies and healthcare and everything else. Exactly. But it all boils back to the insurance companies supporting their candidates in Congress and the defense industry doing as well and looking at lobbying. So I'm saying that at the root of this, that at least a place where we can start is campaign finance reform. And again, this is one of those issues where we're hearing crickets. Nobody's talking about
nobody. On the money thing, Bernie Sanders wrote something at Counterpunch. Taxpayers paid billions for it. So why would Moderna consider quadrupling the price of the COVID vaccine that we paid for? Okay, I just want to remind, we guaranteed everything for Moderna. And then Moderna still has the chutzpah to do this? Oy vey. All right, last but not least, Lincoln, the Christian Science Monitor wrote a piece the other day, and it's about Biden's tack to the center should come as no shock. And I'm looking at all the things we're talking about. And I said this on Friday on the show, and I'll say it again today on Monday on the show. And that is, the center now is so far to the right that his tacking to the center is terrifying to me, because where he is going is where the Republican Party used to be, not where the Republican Party initially is today. And what does that say to young people, to people of color, to women, to the issue of healthcare, on the issue of abortion? Because that center is so far off to the right.
I think it's a reasonably complicated question, right? I mean, Bill Clinton's center was further to the right than Joe Biden's by quite a bit, right? So those of us who are on the progressive wing of the Democratic Party are never going to be satisfied with people who live in the center of the Democratic Party. And that's just the reality. But your point is a very good one. And I want to tie it back to this discussion about Nancy Pelosi. Because in my experience, when that happened, talking to young people, including students and people like that, it was a much bigger deal than I think a lot of older Democrats realized.
Yes, thank you.
Because the thing that a lot of young people believe about the Democratic Party is that they're corrupt and they're pro-business. And they at times overstate that. A lot of my lefty friends at times overstate that. But then Nancy Pelosi comes in and does something like this. And the messaging there is very clear. At a moment when Nancy Pelosi is being celebrated as, you know, the greatest Democratic leader since, I don't know, FDR.
Right.
And then she comes in and says, at the end of the day, it is a higher priority for the Democratic Party that members of Congress can get richer than it is to have accountability and honesty in our legislature. And there's no other way to interpret what she did. And the impact of that is enormous. And as we think of what is the next generation of that party, this party going to look like? How are we going to bring those voters in? And the answer is not just endless octogenarian center-right Democrats. And in his heart, that's what Biden is. He was pushed leftward for a while because of the times and the moment and the kind of politics of the Democratic House and Senate. But that has changed, and it is instinct to think he has to tack back to the right. And strategically, I'm not sure that's even true.
I'm going to give you a GPS, everyone. And the GPS is I'm going to go to Michigan. Why am I going to go to Michigan? Because of what Gretchen Whitmer is doing. She finally, in how many, 40 years, 50 years, she finally has a trifecta. The governorship, the House, and the Senate. They are not wasting any time. Let me repeat this. Any time. So when it comes to things like, you know, repealing right to work, when it comes to abortion, when it comes to so many things, they are moving at rapid speed. Because as Gretchen keeps saying, and as the Democrats are saying, is this is the promise we made to voters. We cannot just make a promise and not deliver. And we cannot not deliver when we're in control. I mean, it just is mind blowing to us. And we learned something very interesting the other day. Gretchen Whitmer is in a dilemma. It turns out that on the right to work bill, the question is, it could actually go up for a referendum. Except there's a law in Michigan that says if you attach a financial note to a bill, it cannot go up for referendum. So they throw in like $2 million with the repeal of the right to work. But Gretchen Whitmer said that she would never pass a bill. She would veto any bill that a dollar attached that would preclude it from going up for referendum. So here she said, I believe in repealing right to work. And here she said, I have made this promise about, you know, not being able to go to a referendum. She's in a dilemma. Okay. Solomon and the baby. And my suggestion to her is go exactly to the voters and say, what do I do? They're conflicting. And then what she says is, but the higher authority is to protect workers, not to protect that statement I made. I just think that is the template. I wish that was the template for Joe Biden. And on that note, this is our Rethink the Week, the Monday edition. I want to thank our fabulous panel of guests, Val Endres, Stephen Pimper, Lincoln Mitchell, and Dave Leventhal. We will schmooze on Monday, everyone. Ciao. You better think-